Happy Sabbath, everyone. It's never, never a calm moment. It's a pleasure to be here with you all today. It's been a while since I've been up here. I actually don't remember the last time. It feels like my life has been a blur, you know, just lots of things going on. You know, they say when you have a newborn, you're never gonna sleep again. And you're like, sure. Yeah, I believe it when I see it. And then it happens, and you're just like, they were so right. You know, everyone was so right. You know, it's been really interesting. Last 8 weeks, he's 8 weeks old now, which is crazy to think about. But it's kind of just been like this twilight zone. I feel like my life is always either like going really fast or it's like taking really long. So it's been a long time being since I've been up here, and I know life just gets busier, but it's been such a blessing to have him. So it's crazy because at the same time, you know, as this was happening, Ariana and I had made the decision to make this my last year of teaching and to enter into the ministry. And it's such an amazing opportunity, you know. I feel so blessed to have, and I didn't think it was going to happen this early, but I'm getting emotional. Wednesday this last week was my last day with students, and as of Thursday, I had my last day at high school, which is mind-blowing. You know, I don't think it's actually sunk in yet that I'm no longer going to be a teacher. All right. It was bittersweet, you know, saying goodbye to the students the last couple of days. You know, I had so many opportunities. It was so funny, you know, the last couple of days that I had my kids. I'm like, I got to tell you guys something. I'm like, they're like, what? I'm like, I'm not coming back. And they're like, what? Are you serious? I'm like, yeah. They're like, where are you going? I'm like, most teachers leave to go to other teachers. I'm like, well, I'm joining my church's ministry or trainee program, and I'm gonna go be a pastor. And they're like, whoa, like that's kind of cool. And I was not expecting the responses that I got. You'd be amazed how many kids are confused with what a priest is and a pastor. I had one kid on my last final. I was grading it. One of his last questions said, forgive me, Father Vasquez, for I do not remember how to do this question. I don't know how many times I told them in the last 2 weeks, I'm not going to be a priest. And they thought it was funny. They just kept throwing jabs at me. I'm like, I'm not a priest. I'm like, do you even know what a priest is? They were like, no. I'm like, well, do you know what it takes to be a priest? They're like, no. I'm like, well, you can't be married and you can't have kids. So I'm automatically disqualified. I have both of those right now. You know, but there's this special energy that you get from kids that just, they come in and they ask questions. In the last couple of weeks, they all came in and said really nice things. And it's been a really a big blessing being a teacher in high schools and teaching math, you know. You get into the school system, and my job was to be a math teacher, and I did my best. I tried to teach math as best as possible, but as I was going through that process, you start to realize that these kids that are awesome in so many ways, some of them are a pain in the butt, I have to say that, but some of them are just so awesome, and all they really need, you know, my job was to teach them math, but what they really need is someone to be a mentor, you know, someone to show them how to live life. And it's amazing how much just growing up without parents or growing up with one parent or just all the different situations that these kids come from. And so, you know, it hurt my heart to see that so many kids are out there just needing someone and needing something that the school system really can't provide, you know. And so in a lot of ways, I felt like I, okay. Good thing it's a sermon. I could take my time and not cry. In a lot of ways, it felt like that was me for them. I had a lot of kids that their parents would come in, and as I was getting closer to joining the ministerial trainee program, we had parent-teacher conferences, and I had teachers come up to me, or parents come up to me, and they're like, hey, I don't know what you're doing with my kid, but he hated math before, and he's doing great in your class. Like, is there any way that he could request to have you next year? And I'm like, no, that's not how the school system works. Sorry, I can't let you recommend that. Little did they know that I wasn't going to be coming back. But, you can see the emotion. As this time has been coming to an end, it was really weird going to school and knowing that this was going to be my last year. I had this weird emotion that I wasn't expecting, you know? I was so excited to start this new adventure. But when the time came to take that leap, you know, I started thinking about all the things that I've been talking about. And you kind of enter into this mourning process. You know, you feel like you're mourning the loss of this previous life, as much of it has, like, its ups and its downs, and it's all over the place. And some days you come home and you're like, I can't believe I'm doing this. This is the worst career ever. And then other days you come home and you're like, I could do this every day for the rest of my life, you know? But the difficult part is, as you lose this phase of life, I have to be willing to forsake that old path and trust that God is guiding me to make the right decisions, you know, and sacrificing my job as a teacher to serve in the ministry in some ways. You know, I'm taking a leap of faith that God is actually calling me to this role. And, you know, I'm learning to trust in God and hopes that I'm following his command, even though it might feel counterintuitive. You know, counterintuitive to my human nature. It's like I'm giving up a job that I spent 5 years to go to school for, and I've been working really hard at. And so that idea of this counterintuitive thing that God calls us to is something that the message that I want to talk about today, because I think that's a huge role in the Bible. You know, the world that we live in is a very complicated place. You know, we live in a society that has all these specific norms and standards, you know. Most kids go through school, into college, and then into the workforce. You know, people who make the most money are considered the most successful. And at the same time, we're born with these certain desires and behaviors that are all kind of ingrained within us. We have desires, you know, simply like hunger or thirst. But we also have desires like wanting to work with people, or wanting to work behind a desk, or wanting to work on things. We all have these natural desires that are ingrained in us. And so when we combine this nature and this setting of the environment around us in combination with who we are, we're presented with this chaotic world full of all of these competing values and beliefs and desires and morals and standards. And it's within that world that we are presented with just a tremendous amount of choices to make on a day-to-day basis, you know? Man left to his own devices is just hoping and just praying that they make, not even praying, man left to his own devices, they're just hoping that they make the right decisions. You know, and on top of all of that, just to make the cake a little bit more complex, on top of all the chaos and decision-making that we have to do, we also have these desires that can be twisted and manipulated by this spiritual realm that is constantly battling all around us. Again, the world that we live in is a crazy and chaotic place, as we all know. But through all of these dynamics, through all of the chaos, the Bible tells us that following God and embracing the Spirit of God is the only way that we can navigate through the dangerous waters, which is shown in this really profound way. I've been really interested in Genesis 1, so we're going to start in Genesis 1. It's really described in this profound way, Genesis 1, a verse we've read a million times. Even if you didn't read the whole Bible program, you at least got to the first day. You at least got to Genesis 1, 2. Hopefully. If you didn't, you got to try hard, a little bit harder. Genesis 1, 2. We'll start in 1:1. It's only one verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And verse 2 is what we're going to focus on for today, or for this first part, is the earth was without form and void. and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Now, at first glance, you won't notice this because it's because of the English, right? The English here, we're translating Hebrew to English. But in Genesis 1:2, you have this idea of tohu vabohu. We talk about that all the time, this wild and waste. And there's nothing except this darkness that's over the face of the deep. Darkness over the face of the deep. If I were to ask you, what is the deep that it's talking about here? What would you say? What is the deep? I think most of us would, when we think of this idea of the deep, we'd imagine the ocean, right? The deep ocean. And that's good because that's exactly what it's talking about here. You can imagine the scene of, it says, the world was without form and void and darkness is over the face of the deep. You can imagine, in my head, I just think of like the movies when they're out on sea and the boat is just getting crash, bang, and it's like the sea is going crazy. And so you can kind of imagine this as Genesis 1:2, the first part. But notice the second part of the verse, it says this: and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. So what's that? Well, at first glance, you could imagine, the first thing that came to mind before I knew what's going on here is I imagine Jesus on the waters when the disciples are like on the seas and he's calming the storm. But in reality, that is not what is being articulated here. And this is why. In the first part of the verse, or two, the word for the deep is the Hebrew word tahom. I tried a transliteration of T-A-H-O-M. Tahom. It stands for exactly what we were talking about, the deep sea. But as you come upon that second part of the verse, the word for water changes. The word for water goes from tahom to hamayim, H-A-M-A-Y-I-M. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but I've heard people pronounce that word, and I think that's how it's pronounced, hamayim. And so you might be asking, what does the word hamayim mean? And the answer is, it's not the deep chaos waters. But instead, it's describing spring waters that lead to life. Spring waters that lead to life. So right here in verse 2, we kind of get this profound lesson that in the midst of the chaos of this world, the tohu vabohu, that the Spirit of God could change the waters, the chaotic waters, the tahom, to the water ready for life. Hamayim. You know, when God starts to create after this, and it has this cool imagery where you can imagine that where the Spirit of God exists, where the Spirit of God doesn't exist, chaos ensues. But where the Spirit of God is, life begins to grow. Which is exactly, in a metaphysical sense, what we see playing on in the world around us. We can kind of see anyone who has established a real relationship with God, regardless of the circumstances, seems to live a more meaningful life. I was listening to a podcast. I know I talk about podcasts all the time. The other day by this guy named John Lennox. He's in his 80s. He's been doing apologetics for Christianity for a long time. But he made a really interesting fact. He said he was talking about people who have faith as they get closer to death versus people who don't have faith as they get closer to death. And he made the point that for people who believe in God, or sorry, let's start at the people who don't believe in God. For people who don't believe in God, the closer they get to death, the smaller and smaller the time frame of the way that they view the world gets. You know, they think, how am I going to get through the next year? How am I going to get through the next month? How am I going to get through the next week and day and hour and minute? And that time frame of survival just gets smaller and smaller and smaller, just trying to survive. But the fascinating part, and you could kind of start to imagine, people who believe in God, and I think he was primarily referring to Christians here, the closer and closer they got to death, the larger and larger the time frame they thought about gets. They start to think about their family and their legacy. They think about God and being a part of the kingdom. And so I bring this up to speak to the point that we are all living, and we all know, to bring up to the point that, as we all know, living God's way has so many positive impacts on our lives. But the thing about God's way that I had mentioned briefly at the beginning is that living God's ways and following God's commands doesn't always intuitively make sense to our corrupted human nature and the world around us. But it's through these commands, through following God and trusting in Him, and leaning not on our own understanding, that we find life. There are so many examples throughout the entire Bible where God commands His people to do things that are counterintuitive, where He demands them to do something that seems like it's going to lead to death, and in some cases it does. Yet over and over, when God's people choose to follow Him, they receive life. And when they decide to disobey, they receive death. If I were to ask you to think about stories where God's commands seem to be counterintuitive, or like they are going to lead to death, and yet somehow they lead to life, what stories would you think of? I like having this because we fellowshiped after services. That might be a good conversation starter. What stories come to mind? I'm going to go through a couple today just to illustrate the point, because underlying this whole idea, I think there are some key lessons and takeaways that we can think of as we move forward in our lives. As always, the question I always start with is, where should we start? And of course, we should start right at the beginning. God's first command in the Bible. We're going to stay in Genesis. You can turn over to Genesis chapter 2 if you'd like. What is God's first command to mankind as He's going through creation? And it comes in Genesis 2. We probably all know this by heart. Genesis chapter 2, verse 15. Genesis 2, verse 15. Then the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, "Of every tree of the garden you may eat freely, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat of it. For in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die." And then when Satan, if you want to look over at chapter 3, when Satan goes on to tempt Eve, notice what he says. The serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die," verse 4, Genesis 3, verse 4. "For God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." The interesting part about this story and about this command of God is that this story is so well known. Everyone has read this story. Again, you start the Bible plan, it's chapter 2. We all know, and it's so well known, don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Why are you doing that? Don't eat from it. We read it so often, but we'd never ask the question why. Or maybe we do, but we don't often. Why? Why do we not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Because when you think about it from a human point of view, it actually doesn't make sense at first. Why wouldn't God want mankind to have the knowledge of good and evil? Isn't that a good thing? Shouldn't we all want to know what is good and what is evil? Which is such a good point, because the reason I know it's such a good point is because that's exactly where Satan strikes. He says, "You will not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open," and here's the enticing part, right? "And you will be like God, knowing good and evil." It's so conniving, but it's so genius. If you were to try to manipulate someone, of course, don't you want to be like God, knowing good and evil? If I know good and evil, I will become like God. Why would God, another question people ask, you know, people who read this story and aren't believers, they would ask, why would God create something that He didn't want us to eat? Think about it. If you didn't know this story and you read that God tells you that this tree gives you the knowledge of good, but don't eat it, good and evil, but don't eat it, from an intuitive sense, as a human being, at first, you would ask, why not? Doesn't God want me to know the difference? You know, I could pose the question to you all, don't you think God would want you to know the difference between good and evil? I think we would all think so. Isn't the Bible a whole story about God trying to teach humans about what is good and what is evil? Right? The whole Bible is a story of this. So the question still remains, why did God not want them to take from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Well, I could summarize it. We had a Father's Day message. I could summarize it in the most dissatisfying answer that a child could ever get. Simply put, because he told them so. Right? No one likes that answer, but in reality, that is God's prerogative, you know? But if we were to break it down a little bit further, the truth is, God had given Adam and Eve a commission. Be fruitful, multiply, and subdue the face of the earth. God had given them all of the trees of the garden to eat except for one tree. And he only had one command, he only had one request in the face of all of these blessings that they were given by God. One command, don't eat from that tree because you will die. But the test was, are they going to listen to the command from God and trust in the goodness of him? Are they going to trust that even though it seems like they should want to have the knowledge of good and evil, are they going to trust that it's true and that it's good, that God does not want them to have it? The sin of Adam and Eve really encapsulates so much of the entire Bible. God wanted to make mankind to trust in him and follow his commands, and not to be like God on their own, because they were already made in the image of God. God, of course, wants us to know the difference between good and evil, but not as we discern, but as God discerns. From a human perspective, it is a little uncomfortable and counterintuitive to want to wait. We have to wait for the knowledge of good and evil. We have to wait for God to show us this. You know, missing in the story, it doesn't say, like, don't eat of this tree of knowledge of good and evil now, because I'm going to teach you the good and evil later and teach you how to live my way. It doesn't say that. And so you're like, of course we should want to know this, right? But the lesson here is that, are we going to trust in God's commands and that his commands are good? This theme, as I said earlier, plays a role throughout the entire Bible. You know, Adam and Eve are the embodiment of failing to trust in God's command. But the next command that we get in the Bible, the second command, is an example of a success. Another trivia question. You don't have to answer it. You can see if you get it in your head. What is God's second command in the Bible? Give everyone a second to think, see if you got it. The second command in the Bible comes in the story of Noah. We could turn over there, Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6. We're going to read starting in verse 7. Starting in verse 7. Genesis 6, verse 7. Kids will laugh at that. If you get it, you get it. All right, sorry. Inside joke. I'm going to pause here. Kids are like 6'7", ha 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 ha, and it's really obnoxious, so I had to call it out. Genesis 6, starting in verse 7. I got you guys. Genesis 6, starting in verse 7. The Lord is in this, the beginning of Genesis 6 has this whole story about the falling of just how mankind became corrupt and their thoughts are evil. And in Genesis 6, verse 7, the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth. How we have just removed ourselves from Eden. He says, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But the key here was Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And so when you drop down to verse 11, it says, the earth was also corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Here goes the command. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood. Make rooms in the ark and cover it inside and outside with pitch. And this is how you should make it. And he goes on to do all the directions. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, and its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. And you shall make a window for the ark, and you shall finish it. And he goes on and he lists all the commandments, because in verse 17, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing in all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you, and they shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, and the animals after their kind, and every creeping thing of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come to keep them alive. And you shall take for yourself of all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourself, and it shall be food for you and for them. And notice what it says in verse 22. Thus Noah did, according to all that God commanded him, so he did. Think about this one. Noah is living in a wicked and perverse world, as described. God says to Noah, I want you to build an ark, and I'm going to save you. And without any dialogue, no discussion, Noah says, thus Noah did, according to all that God commanded him, so he did. He then is said, some people said 100, Ariana was debating me on this. I think some research says he was building an ark for 75 years. I want you to imagine this, put yourself in Noah's shoes. You're building a boat for 75 years when there is no flood in sight. And you're in a world full of wickedness. How much pushback do you think he received? You can only imagine the response to people around him as he's building this massive boat. How would the people have treated him? But when the floods came and Noah had listened to God's commands, he and all of his family were delivered from the chaos. Now, from an outsider's perspective, prior to the flood, the idea of building this ark feels a little bit kooky. You know, like this guy is building the ark. They probably knew he was the ark builder. He probably had nicknames and they probably made fun of him. But as a reader, if you didn't already know this story, you would also think, this is a strange request from God. Now, why would I say that? Well, the funny part, again, with the language, we kind of miss some things with the language. The word for ark here is the word teva, that's how it is. Teva. I spelled it T-E-V-A-H. I don't know exactly how accurate that is, but it's transliterated that way. Teva. And it's a really unique word that is only used in two stories in Scripture. Another trivia question. I like having trivia questions. They're fun. Does anyone know the other place where the word teva or ark is used? I heard someone whisper it, so you got that. The word for teva is the thing that Moses' family puts him in when he went down the river. That thing that they put him in on the river was used the word teva. Which when you start to put the stories together, I'm not going to have time to go through, and compare Noah and Moses, you get a really cool parallels. But the reason why this word is so unique is that it's not even believed to be a Hebrew word. So if you were reading this story in Hebrew, you would get to this word and it's supposed to jump out at you. God is asking Noah to build a what? The word actually is believed to be an Egyptian word. You would automatically assume that it would be the Egyptian word, right? He's building a boat. You would automatically assume that the word he's using is the Egyptian word for boat, but it's not. It is not the word for boat. The word teva could actually, and when I found this out, I was listening to something and I found this out. The word for teva could literally be translated as a coffin, as a chest or a coffin. So if you were to go back and reread the scripture, but instead of the word ark, we would put the word coffin, and we're going to do it because it's just really jumps out at you. You would start to just see how counterintuitive this commandment actually is. God tells Noah in verse 13, if you're still there, Genesis 6, verse 13. And God said to Noah, I'm going to insert the word there, the end of flesh has come before me. The world is going to come to an end. The earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy the entire earth. And in verse 14, make yourself a coffin of gopher wood. Make rooms in the coffin and cover it inside and outside with pitch. And he, as we read before, goes and does all the thing, and he describes all the dimensions. And in verse 17, just because for the effect, it says, and behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from heaven. He's describing destroying everything that is going to die. And I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the coffin. Verse 18, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. And every living thing, as we read, is going to go into the coffin to keep them alive with you, and they shall be male and female. Isn't that so weird? God is telling Noah that he is going to flood the world and wipe out all things that are living. But I'm going to save you, so build a coffin. Not only build a coffin, but stuff that coffin with all of this life that I'm going to save with you. And Noah didn't ask any questions. At least not that we have, you know, maybe he had a conversation, but as it's recorded, it's short and sweet. Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him. So he did. Again, we have this privilege of looking back on the other side and saying, well, of course Noah should build an ark. Of course he should listen to God. But when you think about it, God is asking this man who is righteous in his days to take on all of this scrutiny of the world to build a coffin in which God, is going to put all of life in, and to trust, keyword trust, that God is going to save it through these chaos waters of the flood, and not only save it, but to save it through this coffin, right? Think about how, from a purely human perspective, just how counterintuitive and weird that is. And yet Noah trusted in God and kept his command. And it's through this thing that seemed like death, he's entering into a coffin, he's building a coffin, that God gave life to all. It's through this putting the life into the coffin, coming out of the chaos waters, that he brought life to all. Does that sound familiar? You know, the same pattern shows up over and over throughout the entire Bible. I don't have time to go. I had so many different stories that you could go through, which is why I said it's a good conversation for after the sermon. But we have so many examples where God's commands seem to be counterintuitive to our human nature. Commands that seem like they lead to death, and often in some way, shape, or form, they do. And yet over and over, even though they seem this way, they lead to a better life as long as the person learns to trust in God and follow what he says. You know, there are so many examples to go through, as I said just before, but the most profound and the deepest example comes in the story of Jesus. Jesus is the ultimate example of this idea. God's commission to him was to come to earth, live a perfect life, righteous amongst the nations, and to come and be crucified. This right here is the embodiment of the counterintuitive nature of God's commands in relation to our human nature in every capacity. Why would God, on Earth's ultimate commission, send his son to be killed in the most horrific way possible? Again, we have the privilege of seeing the full story. But to someone who lived during Jesus' time, this would absolutely make no sense in a human nature point of view. Why would the Son of God come and die? Why wouldn't he come and bring life? And we know he did in other ways, right? But they were wondering, John the Baptist comes to him and he says, are you the one? You know, they're wondering, like, aren't you going to be the one that brings life in the way that I, as a human, expect you to bring life? But it's because in the death of the Son of God that the potential for eternal life became possible. Through the death of Christ, his blood was shed for our sins, and he overcame the world. He experienced the ultimate version of this theme that we've been talking about. And listening to God's commands, even when they seem so counterintuitive, even when they seem like death, like building a coffin. And even in death, if we learn to trust God and keep his commandments, he shows that we can receive life. It's through the counterintuitive sacrifice of the Son of God that mankind wasn't liberated from Rome, but liberated from their sin. Liberated from the death penalty that their sin caused. And there's this really powerful portion that I'd like to turn to in the book of 1 Corinthians, if you'd like to turn there. In 1 Corinthians, Paul, having an expertise in the Old Testament and fully understanding the full picture of God's plan, in 1 Corinthians, he says this thing, and it's so profound. We're going to start in 1 Corinthians chapter 2. Of course, I didn't write the chapter in my notes. 1 Corinthians chapter 2. And I believe we're going to start in verse 6. Yep, verse 6. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 6. What he says here really speaks to something super profound. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 6. He's in the middle of a point, but he kind of encapsulates it here. He says, however, we speak wisdom among those who are mature, yet not with the wisdom of this age, not of the wisdom of the rulers of this age who are coming to nothing, but we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the ages of our glory. This is the part right here, verse 8. Which none of the rulers of the age knew. For had they known, for had they understood, they would have not crucified the Lord of glory. If they had understood, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. Notice what Paul just said here, because it's extremely profound. He starts in verse 6, and even before that, saying, what I'm about to say to you is not of this world. The rulers of this age are coming to nothing. The wisdom that I came to speak is wisdom that God had established before this time so that we might receive glory. And none of the rulers of this age knew of this wisdom. Why? Because if they had known, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of glory. They wouldn't have crucified Christ. Paul right here is describing the exact essence behind the message that I wanted to bring today. The wisdom that God ordained since the beginning has been counterintuitive to any wisdom of this age. If they had understood that God's laws and commands aren't the same as man's commands, they would have understood that it's through going counter to culture. It's through going counter to culture around that you find life. It's through willingly sacrificing to follow God's commands that life becomes meaningful. And ultimately, in the example of Christ, It's through being willing to offer it all to follow God and keep his commandments that we can live the most meaningful life. Which is so fascinating that the powers of this age didn't understand this nature. Because it was the entirety, it's fascinating that they didn't understand the nature of God's message. Because it was the entirety of Jesus' message. Which is why Paul says, in emphasizing how they didn't know, if you're still there, 1 Corinthians 2, verse 9, describing how they just didn't understand. But as it is written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor have entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. The funny part is the thing that they just couldn't grasp was the entirety of Jesus' ministry. His entire ministry was towards addressing our corrupted human nature and showing that that leads to death. And showing us ultimately that what spirit-led things that lead to life. Showing us the spirit-led things that lead to life. And all of the things were countercultural at the time. That's the beauty and profoundness behind the Beatitudes. I want to read them because it shows just how counterintuitive they are if you want to turn there, Matthew chapter 5. We're not going to have time to go super deep into what he's saying. But I want you to put yourself as if you were listening to Christ say these words. And you're living in the first century Greco-Roman world. Right? You're there in the Greco-Roman world. Christ is getting up to say these messages. But the world that you live in is all motivated. And all motivated and all of our goals are about social standing, power, wealth. All of these things are equated with divine favor. If someone was weak or vulnerable, they were not embraced and supported by society. They were ostracized. And it's in that world that Jesus opens his Sermon on the Mount, the crux of his teachings, his central message in Matthew 5, verse 1, with just these counterintuitive messages. And it's so beautiful to read. So we're going to read it in Matthew chapter 5, verse 1. Jesus, seeing the multitudes, he went up onto the mountain, and he was seated with his disciples, and they came to him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled." You can just see how he's pulling on these threads. "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the poor in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. And blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you and falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." The core message of Jesus' teaching was the state of someone who is living the good life, blessed, right? The state of someone living the good life is not someone who is necessarily material wealthy or famous. It's to be the opposite. It's to be humble and spiritually rich. The spiritually rich mystery that God gave us understanding of the spiritually rich mystery that God has given us through his Spirit is that in the face of what might seem like death to the world and the culture around us, if you follow and trust in him and listen to God's commands and are willing to sacrifice anything to do so, it will lead to ultimate life. This profound lesson is something that I believe to be so pertinent in the world around us. We live in a world that tells us our lives should continuously be focused on what's best for me. A world that is about how much money can I make in a year. A world that tells us that all of the relationships in our lives mean nothing to the success that we find. It tells us to strive for all the clothes, the cars, the fancy houses, A world that constantly promotes promiscuity, drunkenness, intoxications of all kinds. And yet the people who partake in all of these things, in whatever form it is, who think they are experiencing life to its fullest, are actually the ones that find the least amount of meaning. And the thing is, I speak about this because it was a path that I had went down as I was going into college and figuring out life. And I pursued a life that, according to men, was not wise. It was according to man's wisdom. And at the end of that ride, at the end of that time, I had never felt more empty. But the more I adopted responsibility, the more I followed God's laws and sacrificed the things that the world was pushing on me, the more meaning I felt in my life. I was talking to Ariana yesterday. She's probably in the back taking care of the baby. As I was planning on writing this message about how awesome God's ways are and how much we can read about all these people's lives in the Bible and hear all these stories and go down all these rabbit holes. But when we take the time to trust God and follow his commands in our lives, no matter how much we have to sacrifice worldly things, the better our lives become. We were talking about, speaking of Father's Day, about how having a kid is such a good example of this. We were talking about, if I were to describe what having a kid is like on paper, you would wonder, why would anyone want to have kids? You know? On a personal level, it makes no sense. The job description is, you will lose a large majority of your sleep. You'll get pooped, peed, and spit up on. You and your spouse will never truly be alone again, and you'll spend a substantial amount of money and devote a substantial amount of time that you will never truly get back. And the list can go on and on in terms of the sacrifices and the impacts on your life. And yet every parent who has had a baby in the way that God has designed it will say that having kids is the best thing that you can do with your life. A completely physical understanding can never fully comprehend the beauty behind having kids. The same thing goes for something like we're doing here today, the Sabbath. The world is in this crash course where we're constantly competing and we're in these markets. Everyone's trying to survive. Survival of the fittest. And yet God's command tells us, stop. Rest one day of the week. Again, on a physical level, this makes no sense. But in reality, if we sacrifice our worldly priorities and set this day aside, the amount of benefits that are reaped are substantial. And as most of you know, the repercussions besides just this one day go way beyond into all other aspects of life. We could do this over and over with every command that God has given us. It looks like we're sacrificing this, but we're so blessed in this. We can go through every story and almost every story and find a lesson where it looked like it was this thing and it turned to this thing. But the key behind all of it is that we must trust in God. Keeping God's commands will only work if we unite with God's Spirit and learn to trust that even though the commands that he has given us seem so counterintuitive to our human nature, if we trust in him and follow what he says, then we will receive life and life more abundantly, even if it initially seems like death. Because that's the wisdom that God ordained before this age. And so as my message comes to close, I was thinking about reading Deuteronomy 30. We should turn there. It's such a beautiful scripture. Let's turn over. Deuteronomy 30. This will be the last scripture I turn to. Deuteronomy 30, we're going to start in verse 11. Deuteronomy 30, verse 11. For this commandment which I command you today is not too mysterious for you, nor is it far off. It's not in heaven that you should say, who will ascend into heaven and bring us it, that we may hear it and do it? Nor is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will go over the sea for us and bring it to us that we may hear and do it? But the word is very near you. It's in your heart, or in your mouth and in your heart, that you may do it. See, I have set before you today life and good and death and evil. In that I command you today to love the Lord your God and to walk in his ways and to keep his commandments, his statutes, and his judgments, that you may live and multiply. And the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you go to possess. But if your heart turns away so that you do not hear and are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I announce to you today that you shall surely perish. You shall not prolong your days in the land which you cross over the Jordan to go and possess. I call heaven and earth as witnesses today against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that both you and your descendants may live, that you may love the Lord your God, and that you may obey his voice, and that you may cling to him, for he is your life, and he is the length of your days, and that you may dwell in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them. So, brethren, as we go out into the world around us, trying to follow God's commandments and keep his laws, let us remember to always trust in him. Even if/when our human nature is yelling at us for doing something that seems so counterintuitive to what it desires. I'm not saying it's easy. It's definitely difficult, which is why every story in the Bible, there's an example where some character falls short. But Jesus Christ, our example, paid the ultimate price so that we might have a chance. And so let us trust God the Father and Jesus Christ, and that no matter how big our sacrifice is for them, that God, through his wisdom, ordained before the ages, has a plan for you, a plan to live life and to live it more abundantly, whether it be now or in the kingdom. We just have to trust God and follow him.